Joe, thank you for the introduction and for inviting me to participate in today's panel and at the conference. As Joe mentioned, I'm an attorney who served on the Maryland Attorney General's Task Force on Electronic Weapons. Fortunately, I was not tasked with coming up with all of the best practices on my own. It was a collaborative effort, and I'd like to spend my time today to share the to talk a little bit about what the task force is, what its goals were, and also to highlight some of the key themes and the key recommendations that were in the report that the task force issued at the end of last year. So the task force was created in October of 2008 when Maryland Attorney General Doug Gansler created the group and tasked it with the mission to come up with a set of best practices to for the use of we're calling it ECWs, electronic control weapons. Obviously, CEDs is another option. Many people use the brand name Tasers. I think we all know what we're talking about, though. But the mission was to create a set of best practices. And what was unique about the approach that this task force had was that it attempted to identify all of the various stakeholders out there and bring them to the table to try to find common ground and to create a set of best practices that addressed everyone's needs and concerns. So while there's a number of best practice guides out there, certainly PERF and the IACP and ACLU has some and Amnesty International, many of those have a kind of a single perspective at the end of the day where they are a single interest that they're focused on. And this task force was designed to break down those interests and to really create common ground and find policies that would work for everyone, which of course means that nobody is fully happy with all of them, but that's usually a good sign that that good compromises were made. The membership of the task force reflected this goal and had a set of broad and diverse policy or broad and diverse groups of stakeholders. Among the 15 members, there are a number of law enforcement officials from both large and small jurisdictions, and also from a federal agency. There were members of the medical community, representatives of civil rights organizations, including the ACLU and NAACP, and also representatives of the legal community. There's a prosecutor, attorneys who have worked both on the plaintiff and the defense side of excessive force cases, and members of legal academia. Over the 14 months that the task force met regularly, it spent an extensive amount of time in the fact-gathering phase. And in fact, I think about the first 10 months of the task force's efforts were focused on getting up to speed as to what was already out there. And we reviewed scores of reports and studies and articles. Presentations to the task force by law enforcement agencies, by Taser International, by the Maryland Medical Examiner's Office. Public hearings were held where number of people were invited, and we had law enforcement officials, civil rights advocates, mental health advocates, Taser International, and also a variety of elected officials show up to share their views on some of the risks and concerns that they see with CED usage. And finally, we also conducted two surveys of Maryland jurisdictions. One was a survey of 32 Maryland jurisdictions for what their policies were and for use of force and training and reporting and so forth for ECW use. And another policy that was focused on the use of force data and demographics thereof. So after all the data was collected and the reports had been reviewed and we ended the information gathering phase, the task force turned to trying to come up with a set of recommendations. And as you might expect, this process was not the most simple in the world and was often very contentious. But at the end of the day, the task force was able to agree to 60 best practice recommendations, and what was I think most important about this is every one of those recommendations was unanimously endorsed by every member of the task force. The areas that the recommendations were in or in planning and implementation, training, use of force, medical care, reporting and investigation, monitoring and data collection, and the task force also identified some suggested areas of research. Now, I'll talk about a few of the recommendations later on. Obviously, there's 60 recommendations, and I think I have 20 minutes, so that means we're not going to talk about all of them. I do have copies of the recommendations here. I didn't bring the full report, but if anyone's interested in seeing all of the recommendations, I'll have some copies up here at the end of the program. And at any point, the report is available online. The website is at the bottom of each of the slides. But before we talk about the recommendations, I want to talk about a few themes that emerged that really, I think, served to form the foundation of the recommendations and the report. The first of these themes is that ECWs are a valuable law enforcement tool when used properly. The fact that this emerged as a key theme was somewhat surprising given where the task force started off and where I think a number of the members of the task force came to it thinking that tasers were not good devices, that they were things they wanted to see moratoriums or completely not used. But once everyone had a chance to understand what the devices do, how effective they can be when used properly, there was essentially no discussion about endorsing a moratorium or suggesting that ECWs not be used, but rather trying to figure out how to use them in a way that allows officers to maximize their benefits while minimizing their risks. The need to minimize the risks, I think, is really the key thing and what emerges the second theme, which is that the risks associated with ECW use are not really particularly well understood. And there's a couple of aspects to this. And first, there's obviously an ongoing debate over the exact extent of the risk of ECW use. That's above my pay grade to figure out. Hopefully some of the folks with the doctorates over here can be helping us with that. But what there isn't much debate about is that ECWs can and have caused death, perhaps not conclusively with the electrical currents, but certainly secondary risks and resulting impacts from what happens after someone has been shocked. So given that, seems to be a disconnect among a number of officers and agencies where instead of viewing the ECW as a less lethal device, they're viewed as almost completely non-lethal. And we saw a number of examples of this disconnect. One of the ones that sticks out in my head is there was a take your child to work day at a prison down in Florida, and the correctional officials there thought that it would be a good idea as one of the activities for the day to discharge their ECWs on their own children. Another one here, actually from here in Virginia, there was a woman, a mentally disabled woman, who apparently liked to listen to loud music while she hula hooped. And when an officer came to ask her to turn her radio down, she refused, and she was shocked with an ECW. There are numerous stories like this that all tell us that there is a disconnect, that people do not fully understand the risks, even if they are minimal risks, of what these devices can do. A second reason why some of the risks are misunderstood is that the physiological effects simply have not fully been studied. As Dr. Hunsaker noted, it is very difficult to replicate actual field conditions in a controlled manner for scientific research. You can't capture all the stressors, if someone's under the influence of drugs, if somebody has some sort of pre-existing condition. These are very difficult things to capture in a scientific research. So for that reason, effects are not known, particularly with respect to certain vulnerable populations, such as those in medical or mental health crises, people who are under the influence of drugs and alcohol, pregnant women, children, the elderly, and so on. And shifting, I guess, to the other end of the spectrum, there is, in addition to the people who view ECWs as non-lethal devices, I think there is a significant population of people who view the ECWs as a, I don't know, perhaps a more lethal device, that we've seen with Amnesty and with other groups, an apparent non-appreciation for what the ECWs can do, and fears that they are going to cause just huge amounts of death or injury. And part of that we've attributed to the fact that a lot of the early research out there, the researchers who did the work had either funding or some sort of affiliation with ECW manufacturers. It's not particularly surprising. This happens all the time in the pharmaceutical industry. The people who have the interest in funding studies are obviously going to be the manufacturers. So whether or not there's actual any linkage there, what happens is it creates an appearance of a conflict of interest, and it undermines the credibility of some of the research and allows people to push aside perhaps valid scientific studies by simply saying, oh, look at the funding of it. This can't be unbiased. The third key theme that emerged was that many agencies' policies do not provide sufficient guidance to allow officers to manage the risks associated with ECW usage. This became apparent when we did our survey of agencies in Maryland and started to take a look at what some of their policies were for when ECW use was allowed. These are some examples. One, to incapacitate a resistive person, to be used on simply non-compliant individuals, to control the situation, and when circumstances are tense, uncertain, and rapidly evolving. These type of vague standards do not provide the type of guidance the officers need to understand when the use of the ECW is justified by the risks it presents. As a result, we see an over-reliance on ECWs and an increase of risk of injury or death. This is particularly true when ECWs are turned to in lieu of verbal de-escalation techniques or other non-force options. Also increases the agency's and officers' exposure to liability. Just in the last month or so, I've seen a couple multi-million dollar settlements. There was a city by Fort Worth, I guess made news about 2 weeks ago, offering $2 million to settle a death that occurred after an ECW deployment. And a city in Missouri just recently settled a case for $2.4 million. And more importantly, they had to agree to a moratorium on ECW use following that settlement. And that brings me to the next point, that these type of policies and these types of uses really increases the public resistance to ECWs. It makes it more difficult for agencies to implement new ECW programs or to expand existing ones. Turn now to some of the recommendations, and I'm just picking out a few what I think were really the key recommendations of the task force. And I think the recommendation that really serves as the foundation for all other recommendations is what the use of force policy is going to be. And not surprisingly, this was one of the more contentious ones that worked out, or to work out, and ultimately we reached this formulation, which everyone signed off on as being the appropriate one. And that is that ECW should be allowed only when an individual's actions pose an imminent threat of physical harm to themselves or others. Now, how this differs from a number of ECW policies that we saw is it does not allow for ECW use merely to gain the compliance of an individual who is otherwise not threatening. So in some of the cases that I described earlier, that's what the type of use we saw. And most of the cases that really sparked the public outrage about ECW usage are in these types of situations where there is no apparent risk of injury, and it's just an officer who's frustrated with a non-compliant individual and is using this new device to to gain that compliance. The task force also recommended that the ECW use of force be included in a broad use of force policy that includes all other uses of force, as well as de-escalation techniques and other non-force options, so that officers will have basically a menu of options at their disposal and can know which options are appropriate for whatever situation that's confronting them, and make it easier for them to transition to other options if their option of first choice is not working. There were a couple of circumstances where the task force found that the standard use of force policy wasn't quite sufficient, and where heightened awareness and justification is needed. One of these are in situational examples where there's a heightened risk of death based on the surrounding circumstances. And in these instances, because the risk of death is elevated, the task force recommended that ECWs be allowed only when deadly force otherwise would be allowed. And these types of situations, persons in elevated positions who are at risk of falling, persons with heart disease or pacemakers, persons operating vehicles or machinery, persons fleeing on foot, and the fleeing on foot, there are two concerns. One is the risk of falling. If someone's running quickly, could fall and hit their head. There's also a concern if the person is of small stature and they have a dart in their chest that potentially could pierce their chest and make contact with the lungs or the heart. Persons restrained in handcuffs, persons in danger of drowning, and in or around combustible vapors or liquids such as OC spray. The other area where additional restraint is required is against certain heightened risk populations. Here, these populations are listed there, again, persons of small stature, persons with heart disease, elderly persons, pregnant women, individuals in mental or medical crisis, and persons under the influence of drugs or alcohol. And in these situations, the law enforcement officials need to be equipped with the latest knowledge about the uncertainties and the potential risks to these individuals. And if they are confronted with a situation where they need to choose whether to use an ECW, they need to be able to articulate justifications to why that applying that increased risk was justified in that circumstance. The issue of the use of ECWs against individuals in mental health crisis is certainly one of much debate right now. There is two very different approaches. One side suggests that the proper thing to do here is to use the ECW quickly so that you can get the individual the medical care they need as quickly as possible. The other, the competing side is that the fear that using the ECW will cause or exacerbate the symptoms that the person is experiencing and could potentially increase the risk of death. So given the uncertainty about this, the task force felt that the simple display of the symptoms of a mental health crisis should not in and of itself warrant use of an ECW. Rather, only when there are no other alternative restraint methods available and if the individual is posing a threat to himself or herself or someone else, should an ECW be used. Otherwise, the officer should be using the training and the de-escalation techniques and other mental health crisis intervention techniques that they've learned to try to find alternative ways of containing the situation. Moving on to training, the general theme of the task force's recommendations on training are that officers need to be equipped not just with how to use the ECW, but also when to use the ECW. And when we did our survey of Maryland agencies, we found that the trainings were often very, very heavy on the mechanics of actually using the device, but very light on on when to use the device and the use of force type considerations. So with that in mind, the recommendations say that the trainings should make clear where the ECW falls within the agency's use of force policy, should provide training on de-escalation techniques and other mental health crisis intervention techniques, should make sure the officers are educated about which populations or situations could create a higher risk of death or injury, and should include a scenario-based training that will help the officers make the types of decisions that they're going to be confronted with in the field. In addition, a training program should have a certification component with an annual recertification. And the agency should also not rely exclusively on materials provided by ECW manufacturers. Our review of those materials found that obviously they didn't have any of the agency-specific type information about the agency's policies or use of force, where it fell on the spectrum, and also appeared to understate the risks or at least the uncertainties associated with using the devices. Another area that the task force made some recommendations was on data collection. They identified about 20 or so specific categories of data that all agencies should capture and track following any sort of ECW use of force. We also recommended that a state entity be tasked with collecting that data and publishing it on an annual basis. And that when agencies, as they are collecting this data, use that as an opportunity to examine the data to see if there are any types of changes that need to be made to their training or use of force policies. A couple of medical examiner specific recommendations in dealing with this concept of excited delirium. First, the task force recommends that medical examiners identify, or for any ECW proximate death, specifically indicate whether the use of the ECW may have or did contribute to the death. And also, if the finding is that excited delirium was the cause of death, the task force recommends that the medical examiner actually identify and explain the actual cluster of symptoms that led to that finding to allow people to go back later when additional information is known and be able to have better information about what about the death itself and to see if there are other linkages once further study has been done. The last area I'm going to mention is the proposed research that the task force thought needed to be done. As I mentioned earlier, there isn't real conclusive research on the physiological effects of ECWs, especially on the non-healthy individuals in controlled situations. And so with that in mind, we recommend additional research for repeated or prolonged applications of the ECWs on persons in heightened risk populations, on persons in medical or mental health crisis, and also when they're discharged in certain areas, specifically the neck, head, or the chest area. And then finally, and I think this should be a good lead into the next presentation, is research on whether ECW deployments affect the numbers, the amounts of use of force, and also the number of incidents of deadly force. Again, those are just some of the highlights of the 60 recommendations. Anyone who wants to take a look at them, I'll have them up here at the end, or feel free to go onto the website and download the full 100-page report or so. Thank you all.